Gosh, you'd think it wouldn't be that hard to push the button two times. Come on, Mike. Like you've done this before. 22 is a psalm. Psalm 18 and chapter 22 are David's psalm. And they are basically David giving thanks to God as a result of all that God has done in his kingdom, specifically after the famine in the land that David had to deal with. We won't read through it all, but just for reference, Psalm 18 and 2 Sam 22 are nigh unto identical, okay? But you can just get it. When you look through this, it's just, you get a feel for what type of king David was. I mean, it's just exalting God. David has a great downwind perspective of who he is and who he is not. You get a fascinating picture of why God, again, chose this guy to be king. So even, 30 plus years, almost 40 years on his throne, he isn't full of himself. He isn't haughty. He hasn't made too many dumb decisions. The ones that he has, he's repented from, and he's a godly king, and he's respected by those around him. Okay, so that's chapter 22. Okay, 23, ladies, is a man's chapter. So, sorry, none of you get to read this morning in chapter 23. 23 is the story of David's mighty men, and we're going to get a little bit of insight into the guys that have surrounded David since he was hiding out in the caves of Adullam up in. Find the word, Mike. It's there somewhere. And Gedi up in the caves. These are the guys. These were the worthless men that came and surrounded David in his greatest time of need. And we just get a little bit of backstory into who these guys are. Okay. So before we get that, 23, 1 and following talks about kind of where David is and just a brief description of him. It's really the end of chapter 22. Okay. Look at 23:1. I just want you guys to see how David is described. Pick up there. Ladies, you can actually read through verse 7, then you have to quit. Okay, 23:1-7 is okay. You've got green light on that.
Now these are the last words of David. The oracle of David, the son of Jesse, the oracle of the man who was raised on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel.
The sweet psalmist of Israel. That's a description of the king, right? Not the battle guy, he's the sweet psalmist of Israel. I just think that's really cool that's how. That's what's going to be etched on his, on his tomb when we see it, hopefully one day when they find it. The Spirit of the Lord spoke to me. His word was on my tongue. I mean, what a neat view of yourself. Like, I speak the words of God. He speaks through me, and as the king, I do his bidding, and I communicate to the people what God wants, okay? Look at the end of verse 3. Who rules in the fear of God, right? Like, I submit myself to the will of God, even as the king, okay? In verse 5, he claims this. This is pretty neat. Read that.
For does not my house stand so with God? For he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For will he not cause to prosper all my help and my desire?
He has made an everlasting covenant with me. Like, 2 Samuel 7 is permanently etched in David's mind because he remembers, I offered to build you a house. God said, thank you. You can draw it up. Your son's going to build it. And is it right for you to build me a house, or should I, as God, build you a house? And he says, I'm going to make you an everlasting line. You are going to be the seed all the way back from Abraham, and your line is going to continue all the way to Messiah. And David, that struck him, obviously, right? But that's what he remembers about himself and who he is at the end of his career. The sweet psalmist of Israel. We don't see in here the battle-hardened, giant slayer. What we see is a guy that loves God in his heart right at the end of his life, okay? Now, 8 and following, here are the boys, okay? These are the guys that fought with David. There's 37 mighty men, okay? Within the 37, there's 3 that are set aside as kind of David's go-to guys, and we're going to get just little snippets on a couple of them, okay? Pick up there in verse 8, somebody with testosterone.
These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Josheb, Bashabeth, a Tachamite.
Yeah, nicely done.
He was chief of the 3. He wielded his spear against 800 whom he killed at one time.
800 guys he killed by himself. Like, okay, so yeah, you're in the top 3. I'll give you that. Nicely done. Keep going, Dave.
And next to him, among the 3 mighty men, was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, son of Ahoyai. He was with David when they defied the Philistines, who were gathered there for battle. The men of Israel withdrew. He rose and struck down the Philistines until his hand was weary, and his hand clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the men returned after him, only to strip the slain.
So he and David roll into a covert mission. They're so battle-hardened that his hand hurts from just battle. He's weary just from slaying people, okay? That's in that day, when that was necessary, that's what they did. So this guy, big stage, pretty impressive. Now, verse 11, kind of the opposite. Small stage, but a big stance. Look at this guy. Keep going.
And next to him was Shema, the son of Agi, the Hararite. The Philistines gathered together at Lehi, where there was a plot of ground full of lentils. And the men fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and struck down the Philistines, and the Lord worked a great victory.
So he's just this guy that we have never heard of. He gets two verses in the Bible. He stands in a plot of lentils, in a field of lentils, right? Where everyone else flees, he stays. He puts down the Philistines. Small stage, but yet he makes a significantly big impact, and God is able to win the battle that day as a result of this guy. Okay, so those are the three that kind of get the most prestige, okay? And then there's a few more that are awesome, okay? Verse 13, three of the 30 men went down to David at harvest time at the caves of Adullam, right? We're going to see that. While he was in hiding from Saul. And David says in verse 15, "Oh, that someone would give me a drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." So three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem. So they go all the way from Adullam, which is in the Shephelah, all the way east, 15 miles or so, that would have been as the crow flies, to Bethlehem, break through the Philistine army, draw water from the well at Bethlehem, David's hometown, bring it back to him in verse 16, and David would not drink it, but poured it out before the Lord. Now, that sounds incredibly offensive, that you're like, what's David saying? They do all this work, and he says, I can't drink that. Look at verse 17.
And said, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of the men who went at the risk of their lives? Therefore, he would not drink it. These things the three mighty men did.
He did it almost like a drink offering in Numbers. He pours it out before the Lord and says, man, I am not going to take advantage of the great work that these guys do. And they would have seen that as even more honorable because David didn't drink it. I mean, how loyal are your men when he says, I want to drink from the well of Bethlehem, and they travel 30 plus miles through the night, break through the enemy camps to get water out of a well and bring it back and say, here you go. Like, here's your Slurpee. And David says, thank you. I can't drink that. So fantastic. All right. Abishai, verse 18, the brother of Joab, he swung his spear against 300 and killed them. And he had his name as well as the three. Okay, so he isn't within the three, but he is bad nonetheless. Okay, here's my favorite guy, 20. Read 20 and 21.
And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man of Kabzeel, a doer of great deeds. He struck down two Ariels of Moab. He also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen.
He went down and killed a lion in a pit on a snowy day, right? Hard task, hard place, hard time. He and a lion, right? It reminds me of that scene from the beginning of 300 where King Leonidas is out fighting that wolf, and you're like, man, it's you and him. Nobody knows about it, and it's do or die, right? And you're not going to get your name in the paper for this one. You're just going to have to step up and perform right now.
Does it snow in Israel?
It does at times, yeah. They had a freak snowstorm in Jerusalem earlier this year. And, so it does. It's kind of like Fresno. It's like when it happens, it's odd, but it does. And then especially up in the mountains, like they have, we talked about Mount Hermon. You guys remember that in training? North of Dan, there's a 9,000-foot elevation mountain up there. So it's taller than Sierra Summit, China Peak. Anyway, so yeah, you can snow ski up there, but mostly in those lands, in the lower lands, even in Jerusalem, it's rare, but they do get snow, okay? Verse 21, this is what makes Benaiah awesome. You remember that scene from Tombstone that we talked about earlier? This is it, okay? Keep going, Dave.
And he struck down an Egyptian, a handsome man. The Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but Benaiah went down to him with a staff and snatched his spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear.
So he goes down to meet this guy in battle. Benaiah's got a knife. This guy's got a gun. He's like, oops, I brought the wrong weapon. I am outgunned. So he just grabs the guy's spear, takes it out of his hand, right? And he's, mine says an impressive man, not a handsome man. I'm not sure why that would be important in battle, but impressive. So grabs his own spear and then runs him through with his own spear. So Benaiah is just one of those guys. So I'm like, man, yes, I want you on my team. So anyway, these are the guys that are in David's clan. I mean, they are battle-hardened. They're great dudes. They're tough, and they do amazing things. And then the rest of the chapter is just, you get a list of some of the things that some of these guys did. Those were kind of the highlights. And then in 25 and following, again, you get a list of all the guys. And the last guy on that list, verse 39, Uriah the Hittite. Okay, so he was one of David's most internal circle battle-hardened guys. All right, so pretty cool. All right. Now, 24, this is odd, okay? This is we're going to see a famine again, and this famine comes right on the heels of the last famine that we saw, okay? So God is doing this again, and chronologically, we stop one and we start another, okay? So this is also recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, and it's immediately following Absalom and Sheba and that kind of whole rebellion and God dealing with all that, okay? So 24:1, ladies, you are free to read again.
Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go number Israel and Judah."
Now, this is kind of weird. It says the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and God incited David to go do this thing. Okay, 1 Chronicles says Satan incited David to do what he's about to do, and I think that's more accurate. Okay, here's what he does.
So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army, who was with him, "Go through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba."
What does that mean, Dan to Beersheba? A whole land, right? North to south. Okay, you guys got the picture?
And number the people, that I may know the number of the people.
So what is David asking to do?
Census.
Yeah, take a census, right? Which, God's commanded censuses before. Count the people, right? We've seen that. That was the book of Numbers, right? We counted people. That's why it's called Numbers. So it's not evil in and of itself. Why would God not want David to do this?
Because he's going to do it pridefully.
It's got to be something about his motivation, right? Why would that be a sense of pride for David?
This is what I've done.
Yeah, look what I've done. It's the end of my career, right? Let me, put a little notch in my belt, see how many people we have, right? And Joab recognizes that. So here, once again, Joab steps up and gives him good advice. Verse 3.
But Joab said to the king, "May the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are. While the eyes of the Lord and the king, while the eyes of the Lord, the king still see it. But why does the Lord, the king, delight in this thing?"
So he says, hey, man, I hope God increases your kingdom 100 times what it is now. But David, why do you delight in this? This is not a good idea. You do not need to take the census. Okay, so he gets rebuked. Nevertheless, verse 4, the king's word prevailed against Joab, against the commanders of the army. Joab sent commanders out, and he does his job. Okay, verse 8, we find out it takes 9 months to gather all the people, to go count them, to get the census accumulated. And here's what they find out. Verse 9, Joab numbered the registration of the people, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who could draw the sword, and in Judah, 500,000 men. So we have 1.3 million people, just men, who can draw the sword, which means 20 and over, 1.3 million men. So we're talking, again, probably close to 3 million plus people in the land, of which 1.3 were battle-hardened or battle-ready men, we should say, okay? So David counts them all. He gets exactly what he wants. What happens immediately afterwards when he gets exactly what he wants in verse 10?
But David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people, and David said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly."
So he gets convicted and he realizes, dang it, Joab was right. I shouldn't have done this. And as soon as he finishes, he repents and he says, this was stupid. And God says, okay, no worries. I forgive you. I love you. However, you knew better, and there's going to be consequences. And here's the hard part about being the king. Okay? The consequences don't necessarily fall upon you. They fall upon the people that you lead. Okay? This is tough. Gad, the prophet, says, verse 12, you get to choose your own adventure. Okay? God has given you three consequences. You get to pick one of the three. It's an odd deal. Okay? Here they are. Verse 13, you shall have 7 years of famine. Anybody got a different number in verse 13, by the way?
Three.
Okay, it's probably three. First Chronicles 21 says three, and there's a theme here. 3 years of famine, 3 months of your foes pursuing you, or 3 days of pestilence in your land. Okay? So you can have no food for 3 years, 3 months of getting chased by the Philistines, or for 3 days you can just submit yourself to God and he can do whatever the heck he wants to for 3 days. What do you think David's going to choose? 3 days, right? 3 days, and not just the days, but man, if I have to submit myself either to a famine or to the Philistines or God, I'd rather God be in control. And God's obviously in control of all three. But he says, you know what? I'm going to give it to God and we'll let him do what he wants. Okay? Verse 15, that's what David chooses. The Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from morning and evening until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba die. 70,000 people because of David's sin. I mean, that's a lot of people. We've seen some big numbers. I don't know that we've seen one that big in terms of even some of the battle stuff that we've seen, you know, even in the numbers, the book of Numbers, when we saw the consequences of Balaam's sin, this is big. 70,000 people die, okay? Now, there's an upside to this, but the downside is pretty hard, okay? David repents, again in verse 17, says, I have sinned, I have done wrong, but these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house, okay? So David's going to do something here in chapter, end of chapter 24, that is one of the greatest acts that we're going to see of his career, okay? 18, watch this.
And Gad came that day to David and said to him, go up, rise and altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of
Aruna, the Jebusite. Also named Ornan, okay? In First Chronicles, his name is Ornan. This guy is one of the most, he owns one of the most important plots of land in the history of the world, ever, okay? We're going to find out what it is, okay? So David goes to this guy, he's just got a threshing floor, right? He's threshing wheat. It's just this place outside of Jerusalem that he owns, okay? David goes up to him in verse 8. David sees, or Aruna sees him coming in verse 20. He bows down before him, and Aruna says in 21, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord that the plague may be held back from the people. So David's here because he needs to get the plague checked. He needs this plot of land from Aruna to build this altar ultimately to God. Okay? So 22, here's Aruna's answer.
All this, O king, Aruna gave to the king. Aruna said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you.
So David offers to write him a check, and what does Aruna say? Take it. And here's all the stuff that you need, not just the land, but here's all the stuff you're going to need for the altar. Now, here is one of the most, this verse in David's life is packed with so much meaning. Okay, read this.
But the king said to Aruna, no, but I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing.
Now, stop there. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord which cost me nothing. Tell me about David's attitude about worship and about sacrifice to God.
It needs to cost something.
It needs to hurt. It needs to cost me something in my life, right? Now, translate that into our worlds. What does that look like as we give to God, right? You guys aren't going to go home and offer sheep. Right? Hopefully not, okay? Or you're going to be calling one of us to get you out of jail. What does that look? How do you translate that into our life? What does that mean in terms of our worship of God and our offerings to God?
We don't just give like what we feel like is comfortable. We have to give beyond that because we have to show that we're actually
worshiping. Yeah. That may be your time. That may be your talents. That may be your treasure. But David refused to offer to God something that was just given to him. Because for him, it's like, great, so somebody gave it to me, I'm giving it to God. Like, what investment is that? So yeah, where's my three-legged, one-eyed sheep? Let's offer that. David says, no, God gets my first and he gets my best. Again, this is at the end of his life, and I appreciate that about David. He hasn't lost that heart to worship and an understanding of what happens there, okay? So David says, end of verse 24, David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. Now, 1 Chronicles 21:25 says there's an additional 600 shekels that were paid for the site, okay? He pays a significant amount for this. He overpays for it. Now, David was the king, right? He's loaded. So it's not like this put him in debt or anything. But he certainly gives to this guy, and he buys it, okay? And as a result, David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus, the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Now, this seems insignificant in terms of, okay, so David goes into land, he buys this plot of land somewhere around Jerusalem, builds an altar, and the plague's checked. So, yay, people stop dying. That's good, right? Now, what did David just buy? He owns this plot of land now. Anybody know where this is? Anybody got a note in their Bible? Right by the temple, okay? The threshing floor that he buys is on Mount Moriah. Does that sound familiar? Where do we see Mount Moriah first in Scripture? Abraham and Isaac, okay? David buys it. Solomon is going to build the temple on this mount. So David and Israel own this land. Now, why is that significant in 2014? Who owns the Temple Mount? God owns it. Do Christians own it? Nope. Do the Muslims own it? Nope. The Jews own it. God owns it. He bought it for his people to offer sacrifice on this place. So if we could just, and Brad will teach this as we get into Israel, boy, wouldn't that be a great receipt to have of all the receipts I lost in life, right? That all my admins had to track down because I couldn't find my $55 gas receipt to get reimbursed from the well. Like, gosh, that's a receipt that I just wish we could say, David owns this. He bought it for God. He built the threshing. He built an altar on the threshing floor. This is Israel's, right? That would be phenomenal, but we don't. So you guys can pray that they'll uncover that receipt someday. I'm sure there was some type of transaction, okay? So because of this awful thing that happened in David's sin, God moves him to buy this plot of land that forever is going to be one of the most important, you know, you talk about expensive location, location, location. This is Boardwalk and Park Place, okay? So we now own, I say we, Israel owns it. We don't own it. God owns it. This plot of land that they're ultimately going to build the temple on, okay? So, all right? So there's 2 Samuel, all right? Now, David's about to die. We're moving into 1 Kings. The story's just going to continue right along. 1 Kings is all about division, okay? Solomon is going to take the throne, and then it is going to divide under him. We're going to see 3 kings again of the united monarchy, Saul, David, and Solomon. The kingdom will split under Solomon, and we will see that this morning, okay? And the why is not a big mystery, okay? Sometimes we look at it from the wrong perspective. But I'll show you this morning why ultimately this happened. And God had warned him numerous times, and we're going to see hints in Solomon's life of where it was headed, okay? But Solomon was a great king to begin with, okay? So let's get into 1 Kings again. Division as the theme, and let's kind of see where David is at. 1 Kings 1:1, this is his physical condition.
Old and well advanced in years, he could not keep warm even when they put covers on him. So a servant said to him, let us look for a younger virgin to attend the king to take care of him. She can lie beside him so that our Lord the king may keep warm. And then he searched throughout Israel for a beautiful girl and found Abishag.
Remember her name. She's important, okay?
Shunammite. And brought her to the king.
All right, so he's old. He can't keep warm. He's in a bad spot. So they find this girl. She's beautiful. It says at the end of verse 4, he did not cohabit with her. So she's there, but David literally doesn't have sex with her, okay? So she's a nurse to him, okay, and is keeping him comfortable in his last days, okay? He is on his deathbed.
I remember seeing that on the news a called cuddlers. They go to
I feel like I heard about that somewhere.
Yeah, and they go and like cuddle with the old people.
What a strange job. Yeah, yeah, no. Take that off my list. I'd rather clean out porta potties, so. Really? You want to go cuddle with people you don't know?
There is nothing wrong with that.
Yes, there is. So wrong. Oh. Yeah, the good news is we'd see a selfie of it, right? So. I've never taken a selfie, I'm happy to say. And now with the... Did you guys see that? They've made that a disorder. They've, like, officially said you're... Tony, not you, but other people who are selfie addicted, I guess. They're saying it's just narcosis. It's, what's the... Narcissistic, thank you. What's the guy's name from the Greek mythology? What was that guy's name? Narcissus, thank you. Hence narcissism. More coffee. All right. So now here's the odd thing. David has not said, I got a gazillion sons, right? He's got a bunch of kids at this point. He hasn't clearly established who's going to be the next king. So opportunity arises. One of his sons, Adonijah, says, how about me? So he says, great, I'll take the throne. I'll be king. Verse 5. And he's a smart guy. Okay, so he's, if not the oldest remaining son, he's one of them. I think he's the oldest remaining now that Amnon and Absalom are dead. His mom, just so you guys know, is Haggith in verse 5. Okay, again, gang, names not to name your children. Females do not need to be named Haggith. Okay, so you talk about an old hag, that's her nickname. That's just bad. So mom is Haggith. Adonijah says, I'm going to be king. He grabs Joab. He grabs Abiathar the priest, and he says, man, I need your stamp of approval. So David's chief general and Joab and Abiathar the priest, and look what they do, end of verse 7, they helped him, okay? So Joab, as is typical, is ready, fire, aim, picks the right or the wrong team. Who's Abiathar, by the way? Which priest? Where does his lineage go? He's not the guy that was related to... I'm sorry, I had that wrong. Who was the guy? Who was the priest that was? Adonijah was the guy that was related to Solomon's grandfather. Not Solomon's grandfather, Bathsheba's grandfather. Who was that that fled with David? Dang it, there's too many names. Abishai? Now I can't. I have to find it. Ahithophel. Thank you. No, he was the guy with. That was the grandfather. Was it Ahithophel? That was the guy that hung himself. Yeah. Dang it, it's top right-hand corner of my Bible. Hold on. Yes, it's Ahithophel. You guys are right, okay? So that's Bathsheba's. He's dead. Never. We can forget about him. Sorry. We've moved on from you, Ahithophel. There's too many A names in this. It's maddening. This is where I get so... Blah, 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 blah. All right. So, my bad. All right, so we've got Adonijah... rising up to the throne, David's oldest remaining son. We've got Abiathar and Joab that are going to go with them. Okay, so they conspire for the throne. It seems like there is knowledge that, hey, David is going to appoint Solomon, but he hasn't officially done it. So David's kind of created this mess that we're about to see. So Adonijah, verse 9, gathers all his boys. They have a big party. They sacrifice, in verse 9, sheep and oxen and fatlings. They invite all these people basically to a dinner party. And Adonijah is just going to exalt himself to the throne and make sure that everyone knows about it, okay? Nathan goes to Bathsheba and says, hey, by the way, this is not good. Your son Solomon is supposed to be king. You need to get with David and get him to make a decision, okay? So you're seeing this passivity on a bad day from David, lack of decision-making for whatever it is. Maybe he's sick. Maybe he's just not, I don't know, maybe it's not on his mind. Maybe he's trying to hang on to the throne too long. But for whatever reason, typical of sometimes the older people that are on the tail end have not done a good job of exalting the next generation. He's finally going to do it, but it takes someone to say, listen, look, Dave, we basically got a gun to your head at this point. There's about to be a coup in the kingdom. You've got to make a decision, okay? So he does. He gets word. They tell him, look, this is what Adonijah's doing. He's taking Joab. He's taking Abiathar the priest with him, and Bathsheba goes into the king's bedroom in verse 15 and communicates all that's happened. Okay, she says in verse 17, "Surely your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne." So this had already been communicated at least to Bathsheba. She knew Solomon was supposed to be king. Adonijah's taking it. And in verse 20, this is what she says to David.
"And now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on me to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king."
Like, everybody's waiting, right? This is like Groundhog Day. We're all watching for the ground. Like, what is he going to do? Everyone's waiting for David to say, this is the next guy. So he hasn't done that yet, and it's created a bit of a chaos, okay? 28, he gets a second report. Bathsheba leaves. 28, she comes back in. He says, hey, call Bathsheba to me. 29, he says, your son Solomon shall be king after me. So let's make it official, all right? 33, take your servants of the Lord. Have Solomon ride on my mule. Bring him down to Gihon, where there is a spring. Let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him as king over Israel. Blow the trumpet and say, long live Solomon. Okay, so let's not make it private. Let's not make it public. Let's make sure everybody knows about it. But Solomon is the next guy. Okay, verse 39, they do this. Solomon is anointed in verse 39 by Zadok with the horn of oil. So all this is done. Now the problem is Adonijah is in the middle of his, like, I'm going to be king party. And then all of a sudden they hear about, oh gosh, David just made a decision. He decreed Solomon's the guy, not you. And Joab's at this party. All these other, you know, kind of core leaders have run off with Adonijah. And they get word back, hey, David didn't pick this horse. He picked that horse. Y'all are on the wrong horse, okay? So they freak out. Verse 49, all the guests of Adonijah were terrified. They arose and each went on his way. Okay, so David, with his official stamp of approval, has now put an end to this potential coup. Adonijah was afraid of Solomon, and he rose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Okay, so where does Adonijah run? What are the horns of the altar? Yeah, in the tabernacle, okay, the temple to be. So he runs to the tabernacle and grabs the altar. What happens on the altar? It's where you sacrifice things, right? So why would you go there?
Sanctuary.
What's that?
Sanctuary.
It's exactly what it is. Like, you're not going to kill me, like, in the sanctuary, would you? So he runs to church. So that's his get-out-of-jail-free card, okay? And in a sense, that was honored. You're not going to kill people inside the house of the Lord. You drag them outside and kill them, okay? Not really. But that's his idea. Give me safety. And he realizes, man, I made a very clear and strong statement about Solomon. And now my younger brother is going to be king. My younger half-brother is going to be king. And we're not chummy, okay? So Solomon says, listen, no worries, okay? He says in verse 21, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon. Behold, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar. Let King Solomon swear to me this day that he will not put his servant to death by the sword. So Adonijah is looking for, just don't kill me, okay? And Solomon, now you're going to begin to see Solomon's wisdom. Look at 52 and 53.
And Solomon said, if he will show himself a worthy man, not one of his hairs shall fall to the ground. But if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So King Solomon sent, and they brought him down from the altar, and he came and paid homage to King Solomon. And Solomon said to him, go to your house.
So how does Solomon handle this? What does he say to him? What does that mean?
I'm not making any promises. That's up to you.
Yeah. It depends on how you behave. I'm not going to kill you today. And I don't plan on killing you, honestly. Unless you're wicked, I have no need to kill you. I'm not intimidated by you, right? So you see some security in who Solomon is. He feels no need to shed blood. Solomon's not a warrior, okay? He's a wise sage. But he doesn't want to go to battle if he doesn't have to. In fact, he's going to have other people do that for him, okay, for the most part. So he says, go to your house. You have freedom. Just don't be an idiot, okay? And that's basically, he says, it's in your hands, all right? Now, chapter 2, this is the death of David.
How old is Solomon right now?
He mentions it in, I think he's in his 20s? No. Hold on. No, 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 no. He says he's a young man. It's a great question. He's young, 20s or 30s. He's going to pray to God. And he's going to talk about how young he is. I don't know that we get an age. And God is going to bless him because he prays a prayer far beyond his years in terms of maturity. Let me see if we hit it, but I don't think we get an age. But he's a young guy, okay? So Solomon gives him a get-out-of-jail-free card. He's like, great, just don't be an idiot, and we're fine, okay? Now, this is David's swan song. This is his speech to Solomon. This is great, by the way. I want you to see, as David thinks about 40 years of ruling the land, and he says, I've got a deathbed speech to give to my son who's going to be the next king of Israel. This is what David cares about. Okay, just I want you to hear this. Okay, 2 verse 1, pick up there. Now, there's something about that, right? A dad to a son saying, be strong and be a man. It's boyhood days are over. You can't be some 30-something living in mama's basement, eating bonbons, her doing your laundry. Those days are over, okay? Solomon, you're going to man up, okay? And that's what every dad needs to communicate that to their sons. There's a time to grow up. There's a time that you step into manhood. And Solomon, by the way, it's right now, okay? You're a man. You're about to lead the nation, okay? Keep going. Okay, so he tells him essentially two things. Be a man and walk with God. That is your role as a king. Here's how you do battle with the Philistines. Nope. Like, here's how you administrate the kingdom. Nope. You walk with God and be a man. And if you do those things, honestly, you're a man already. So essentially, walk with God. And if you walk with God, we will not fail to have a person on the throne forever because of the covenant that God has made with me and our household. So step up and walk with God. And that's it. Now, David's going to give him some instructions, like some spring cleaning tips and things that he's going to have to tidy up because David didn't deal with them. See also Joab and some other issues. He's going to say, now, I need you to deal with these things. But you're going to see David, the reason he picks Solomon is he recognizes the wisdom that's in him. He doesn't tell Solomon how to do things. He realizes, you need to deal with this issue. You're smart. You'll figure it out. Deal with this. It's brilliant. So you see in him, there's a reason why David picked Solomon. He saw leadership gifting in him that was just off the charts. And we know that, right? How is Solomon, by the way, described in Scripture? He's the wisest man who's ever walked the face of the earth. I mean, holy cow. And David went, yes, if he can walk with God and not get too big for his britches, this guy's going to be unbelievable, right? If the weight below the waterline can outdo the weight above the waterline, he'll rule forever. The problem was it didn't, and something cracked underneath, and the kingdom that was Solomon comes crashing down in a few chapters, okay? So here's what he tells him. Verse 5, now, walk with God, be a man, deal now, verse 5, with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, because of what he did to me and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner and Amasa. What did Joab do to those two guys? Gutted them in plain daylight, right? Just sneaky, dirty. He says, Joab needs to be dealt with, okay? Deal with those guys whom he killed. Also, he shed the blood of war and peace. He put the blood of war on his belt, around his waist, and his sandals on his feet. Meaning, Joab killed guys even in war. That was wrong. And he could not do that. It needs to be dealt with. So, verse 6, act according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace. Meaning, take care of it. Solomon, use your wisdom as to how you want to go about this, but you make sure that it's taken care of. Okay?
Is this something he's known for a while?
Just I think David just couldn't deal with it. And he realizes, man, I should have. And Joab has been my highest of highs and my lowest of lows. But because of his flying off the handle, it's got to get dealt with. And he doesn't want that on Solomon. So he says, put him down now, because you don't need to deal with the same ups and downs that I had to deal with. So get rid of him. So, and he's justified in doing that, okay? So be wise and do that, okay? Show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite. That's the guy that we quickly read about yesterday. He stayed on the other side of the Jordan. He was old, but he showed kindness to David. He took care of him when he fled from Absalom. So he says, make sure you bless this guy, because had it not been for him, we'd have been hot and starving and sleeping on rocks in the wilderness when Absalom was chasing me. So be kind to him. And then in verse 8, David kind of comes back and he says, you remember the guy Shimei or Shimei, the guy that was cussing and mooned David on his way out of Israel, right? I don't know if he really mooned him, but he calls him, he says, now he who cursed me with a violent curse on that day. So I'm sure there were some very colorful language that this guy used. And David was like, man, go deal with this guy. I swore that I wouldn't touch him, but I didn't swear that you wouldn't touch him. So Solomon, go deal with him. Verse 9, do not let him go unpunished, meaning you need to deal with this. Again, he doesn't tell him exactly what to do. He says, but make sure that he's going to feel the wrath of Solomon for disrespecting the office of king. Okay, so verse 10, sad day. All right, so he has control. Now, one of the conundrums, by the way, in Israel is we have, until I think it was 1994, there was zero evidence of David ever living. There was no archaeological evidence of his life ever. So he's buried in Jerusalem. He's done all this stuff. He was the king, and we can find nothing. And in 1994, they found it was like a portion of a letter or something inscribed on, I think it was a stone, that talked about King David. And so many people were saying, see, the Bible's not true, or whatever. They were using that as a defense. But they found very little archaeological evidence of King David's life. It's just strange. So the city that he built and that, you know, he made Jerusalem what it is today, and they could find very little, okay? So now Solomon is going to have to get put into action, okay? Now, watch what Adonijah does. Adonijah was the guy that last chapter tried to take the throne, okay? Now he's going to backdoor creep it, okay? So instead of being like upfront and bold and beat my chest and I'm going to take a coup, now he's being shrewd, okay? Verse 13, watch what he does. Which is a dirty lie. He's, no, it wasn't actually. You thought it was yours. Keep going.
However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord.
So he makes this like, it was supposed to be mine, but God decided that it's supposed to be his. So you're like, I'm not buying it. I see your mouth moving, but that's, I think they're lies. So keep going. Okay, so he goes to Bathsheba. Who's Bathsheba? Solomon's mom. Not his mom. Haggith is his mom. So he goes to Bathsheba and says, hey, I was supposed to be king, not really, but God made your son king. I have one request. I want Abishag, the Shunammite, as a wife. If I ask him, he's going to say, heck no. If you ask him, he'll say, okay. Now, why does Adonijah want Abishag? Who's Abishag? David's nurse. What is he doing?
Sleeping with the concubines.
Exactly. He's taking David's concubines and saying, see, they are mine. Because now I'm the rightful king. It's a backdoor, dirty move. He's still trying to get to the throne by any means necessary. Okay. And Solomon is wise enough to go, no. Abishag took it hook, line, and sinker. I'm sorry. Bathsheba is going to take it hook, line, and sinker and go, okay, so you want a wife and you think she's cute. All right, I'll go ask. So to her, it's that innocent, okay? She comes and tells Solomon, and Solomon's like, respectfully, woman, are you dumb? Like, do you not know what he's trying to do? He says, verse 22, king answered and said to his mother, and why are you asking Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him also the kingdom, for he is my older brother, even for him, for Abiathar the priest and Joab and the son of Jeruah. Why don't you just ask for all these guys to come back in? So Solomon reads through it and he says, listen, Adonijah, I told you I wouldn't jack with you as long as you weren't an idiot. You now have chosen to be an idiot, okay? So, verse 24, now therefore the Lord, as the Lord lives, who has established me and set me over the throne of my David, established me and set me on the throne of David, my father, who made me a house as he promised, surely Adonijah will be put to death today. You had to choose your own adventure. You chose to be an idiot. Now I'm going to kill you. Okay. Solomon sent Benaiah, our boy Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he fell upon him and he died. So Adonijah is dead and he chose that himself. Yeah, Callie.
So is that nurse lady unmarriable now?
Nobody slept with her yet. So David didn't sleep with her, but she was.
But like, would Solomon allow her to get married to random?
Yeah, for sure. She was just an important pawn in the game, and that's how Adonijah wanted to use her. Yeah, but no, she's certainly marryable. So she's described as a virgin, and as far as we know, she still is. Okay. Now Abiathar, the priest, who was with Adonijah in his mock rebellion, he now talks to him and says, go to your own field, for you deserve to die. Meaning, you abandoned my father, and you abandoned me, and you picked the wrong team, but I'm not going to put you to death, because you carried the ark of the Lord of God before my father David, and because you were afflicted with everything in which my father was afflicted. Meaning, you served my dad for a long time, but you bailed at the 11th hour. I should put you to death, but because of your history with my dad, I'm going to overlook it. Go to your house, live in peace. Don't be stupid like Adonijah, or I'll kill you, but I'm going to be gracious. Okay, so you see Solomon, he's not blood hungry, right? He's not trying to prove who he is. He's trying to be wise in the way he administers his kingdom. And now he's got boundaries. You act like an idiot, this is what happens. You want to live within the rules that I set? We're all good. And this guy's going to do it, okay? So he's going to live in peace. Now, last guy, Joab. He followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. So he didn't rebel with Absalom, but he rebelled with Adonijah at the end. Okay, it was told to King Solomon that Joab had fled. Notice verse 29, by the way. Where does Solomon find Joab? Where?
Beside the altar.
Beside the altar. He fled into the tent of the Lord. Okay, so it seems like, based on my understanding, both the ark, okay, the tabernacle, and the altar are all together at the end of David's life. So I don't know what to do with it. So some say that this is a different tent. It seems like this is the tent of the Lord, right? I don't know of other tents of God unless he has like a stockpile. But the only one that I'm aware of is the one that was made 500 years ago in the desert, okay? So this is it. And he says, to Benaiah, the go kill Joab. Okay, he flees and he finds out Joab is sitting on the horns of the altar. He's trying to do the same thing. This is the get out of jail free card. You can't kill me in church, right? So he says, "No, I will not die here." Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, "Man, he's fallen on the altar. Like, what am I supposed to do?" The king said to him, "Do as he has spoken and fall upon him and bury him there. Like, if he wants to die on the altar, let him die on the altar. That's fine. Like, I don't care where he dies as long as he dies." Okay. So verse 34, read that.
Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and struck him down and put him to death, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness.
Okay, so this is the end of Joab's career right here. So Solomon puts him down through Benaiah. Okay, Benaiah again is one of the mighty men. He's the guy that killed a lion in a pit in a snowy day. Okay, and tombstone to that guy. Okay, that's now a verb. You're welcome. So to tombstone the Egyptian. Okay, so he is put down. Okay,
in the temple?
Yep, yeah, it looks like, yeah, he killed him in the not the temple, but he killed him on the altar. So because he wouldn't leave. So well, if you think it's safe there, then you can try all day long, but it's not. So That wasn't his favorite, but that's what he did. Okay. Now Shammai, the cussing mooner in verse 36, he says to him, build yourself a house in Jerusalem, go live there, and do not go out from there to any place. Meaning, I could kill you, I'm not. You get house arrest. So build a house in Jerusalem, don't leave. Okay. If you cross, verse 37, the brook Kidron. Okay. If you cross the Kidron Valley, I'll kill you. If I found out you crossed, I'll kill you. So you can live, but you're on house arrest. Okay. He stays there and says, man, the word is good. Thank you so much. I get to live. That's great. After 2 years, he runs away, goes to Gath, takes a vacation, goes to the coast, comes back, and it's told to Solomon, hey, your boy, Shammai, who cussed out David and mooned him, he left. You told him not to leave. He left, and now he's back. And Solomon comes to him and says, look, dude, I told you not to do stupid. You did stupid. Now I got to kill you. So he kills him. Okay, so that's Shammai's death. So he's a chump. So that's the idea. Okay. 46, so the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went down and fell upon him so that he also died. The kingdom of Solomon was established. So we see him have to deal with these three pretty tough issues, and he handles each one of them different, right? Abiathar, man, I like you. You're kind of a jerk at the end of your life, but you were faithful to David. I'm not going to kill you. Go home. Just don't be stupid. Shammai, you're on house arrest, okay? If you leave, I'll kill you. And I don't want to kill you, but I'm going to give you your own decision. And he does stupid. Joab says, man, I'm just going to kill you because that's what needs to happen with you. So you've killed Amasa. You've killed Abner. We can't have that. My dad said you need to die. So you're going to die. So you see him beginning to use his wisdom to administrate justice differently. All guys that their consequence could have been the same in terms of death, but he chooses to administrate justice differently, okay? So we're seeing a very wise and shrewd young man, okay? Now, 3:1, we're going to begin to see the chinks in his armor, if you will, okay? 3:1.
Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord.
Okay, so today, Egypt and Israel have a peace treaty, right? They sign a piece of paper that says, hey, don't bomb us. We won't bomb you. We'll be chummy. We'll agree to disagree, but we're good, okay? That's how they do it. Back then, it was, hey, Solomon, I'm Pharaoh. This is my daughter. You marry her. You take her in, and that says that you are aligned with us. You've kind of bought into who we are, so you would make a marriage alliance. Now, it makes perfect sense. Like, that's just how they would spit and shake and sign a contract back then. What's the problem when you bring in the daughter of Pharaoh into your kingdom? Who does she worship?
Other gods,
right? Now, what happens when you bring in 10 marriage alliances and one of them worships Ra, the sun god, one of them worships Chemosh, one of them worships Molech, one of them worships Baal, another Ashtoreth, and you got all these women that all are like, Solomon, Solomon, make me happy. Solomon, I want this, I want that. What do you do? Woman, okay, I'll build you an altar to Ra and you an altar to Chemosh, and we'll put in the Kidron Valley your altar, and then over, like, that's what happens to Solomon. These women are like, and you can just see they're nagging women, okay? And they don't mean to be, but this is the downside. When we see God put Solomon's hand on the chalkboard and take the fraternity paddle and spank him, it's not you have too many horses, you're going down. It's not you have too many wives or you have too much money. It is you have let these women pull your heart astray, and you have lost what King David told you not to lose. You have lost your singular, focused heart for God. You start great, and then you caved in the end. And these women led your heart astray to worship other gods. And that ultimately is the straw that breaks the camel's back for God with Solomon.
Would you say that marrying, like, these foreign wives, these, like, princesses or something, is that, like, distrusting God as well? That, like, he feels like he needs to create political alliances instead of trusting God's power?
It's a hard argument. We see, obviously, the heart of all this in the beginning, with God wants one man, one woman for life. I think that clearly is Adam and Eve from the garden on. I don't think it's an issue of distrust. And I think God's like, okay, I'll let that happen. He let it happen with David, right? David never got to the point where he's erecting altars to Chemosh, okay? His heart never got led astray. So David is never punished for having multiple wives. Do we ever see that? No. We would go, oh, that's horrible, right? I mean, we wouldn't let Brad have 9 wives. Like, you look at that and go, wait a second, but our paradigm is different. God never punishes people for that. He punishes them when they have nine wives and they all worship a different god, and then you start worshiping their gods. So that's the issue. So I don't think it was a sign of distrust. I think it was a sign of him trying to be politically savvy, and he thought he could handle it. That's Solomon. He thought a little bit too much of what he could do. And all of a sudden, one day he went, oh gosh, like, this is chaos. And God says, yep. So, okay.
That would be included in the wisdom that he got.
You would think. That's the problem, right? I mean, you're too big for your britches. You know too much. You're too smart. And you just think, it won't happen to me. It's absolutely what it is. So Solomon just, he built a structure on top that the foundation couldn't support. And that's where he crumbled. So, and we're seeing hints of it. Is one wife too many? Is two wives? I don't know. So, okay. Now, here's another interesting one, okay? Brings her into the city of David, okay? Verse 3, the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. So, this is, again, the confusion of, like, what's actually happening with the house of God. It's not... They're sacrificing on high places. Gibeon was a high place. Verse 3, Solomon went there and offered sacrifices, it says, to God, and burned incense on the high places. Now, we're going to see that later, and that is going to be clearly pagan. So whether that is Solomon borrowed from their practices and said, hey, they sacrificed to their gods on high places, I'm going to sacrifice to my God on a high place. Right now, it seems like that's the way it is. Later on, there's going to be confusion on which God Solomon is worshiping. I think right now it's pure. You'd prefer him to be offering sacrifices in the tabernacle, the temple to be, but he's not. But he offers to God, it says, like 1,000 sheep or something. Where is it? Anyway, there's a note in Gibeon. He burns a bunch of stuff up there, okay? There's a text right there. Found it. Okay, hold on just a second. Sorry, conversation's in my head. I'm answering a question that you guys asked a while back, okay? He's praying at Gibeon to God. God comes to him in a dream in verse 5, and God basically says, Solomon, you get a blank check, okay? You pray whatever you want, and I will give it to you. Can you imagine if God said that to you? Like, I know what I pray for, and it's not what Solomon prays for. He says, here you go. You can have anything you want, okay? Verse 6, this is what Solomon says.
And Solomon said, you have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart towards you. And you have kept for him this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David, my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in.
What does that mean? I'm a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Yeah, and he's just saying, man, I'm young. He's 20, by the way. Okay, I looked it up earlier and have a note. So Solomon's 20 at this point. So not the youngest king ever. We're going to see kids that are like 8 that take the throne, by the way, in the days of the kings. It's weird. So he's not by any means the youngest, but he's a young guy. Okay, so 20 years old. And he says, Lord, I don't know what I'm doing, right? My dad was freaking awesome. He reigned for 40 years. I don't know what to do. Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great number who have chosen, too many to be numbered or counted. So this is in verse 9 what he asks for.
Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, and I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this your great people?
I mean, you talk about humility. God, I don't know what I'm doing. Give me your eyes and your heart in discernment. I've got to lead 3 million people, and I don't have the first clue how to do it. And God says, are you kidding me? God says to him, because you have asked this thing in verse 11, and have not asked for yourself long life, for riches, you have asked for the life of your enemies, but you have asked for discernment, okay? I'm going to give you all of this, and then I'm going to give you all the stuff that selfishly you wanted to ask for. I'll give you above and beyond, okay? I have also, in verse 13, given you what you have not asked for, riches and honor, that there will be none like you among the kings all your days. 14, walk in my ways, keep my statutes, as your father David did, I will prolong your days. So Solomon gets a blank check, and man, at 20, he's got the wherewithal to say, God, I need wisdom, and I need discernment. Like, that's what makes him great. And God says, I will give it to you in spades. Okay? So, 16 is the story of the two women that we talked about earlier. Hey, I rolled over on my baby. This baby's mine. No, it's mine. And Solomon says, great, cut the baby in half. And the real mom steps forward and says, ah, give it to her. And Solomon says, great, you're the real mom. You take the baby home. So we're seeing displays of that wisdom.
Would it have been unusual for the king to, like, help the prostitutes? Like, because they came to him to ask him this question. Would it be weird that would they have been, like, outcasts?
They're described as just two women here. But no, I mean, his job is to administrate justice in the kingdom. So... really?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting, yeah. You know what? I'm sorry, mine is two women who are harlots. So, yeah, I suppose. So.
Does harlots necessarily mean prostitutes?
Yes. there's no other way around that one. So.
I'm just wondering, like, if in that culture, were they kind of, like, avoided and, like, brushed under the rug?
For sure. I mean, they would not have been. I mean, similar to our culture, where they're certainly looked on as outcasts. But Solomon uses his wisdom to decide between an issue. So
I have a note on that. It says they stood before him because, in the absence of a second witness to collaborate their testimony, the normally legal procedures could not be followed. The Israelite king represented the highest court of appeal and was the foundation for all administration of justice.
There you go. So, yeah, he judge, jury, executioner. So there you go. Okay. So thank God you got a righteous king, right? Or you have someone, and we'll see those when they go bad, what that looks like. Okay. So Solomon says, divide it in half. Okay. And that's, you guys know the rest of that story. Okay. Now, chapter 4, let's watch how Solomon begins to administrate his kingdom. Okay. Solomon now is going to gather men to himself to help him lead. And I want you to notice how he does this. Chapter 4, verse 1, he's king over Israel. These were his officials. Azariah, the son of Zadok, who was the priest. First guy in Solomon's staff, who is he? A priest. Okay, good move, right? Then in verse 4, he gets Benaiah, okay, to lead his army. Good choice? I'd say so, okay? Then he gets in verse 5, Zabad, the son of Nathan, a priest, the king's friend, okay? Son of Nathan. Who was Nathan to David? The prophet. Who did what with David? He cut it clean. I don't care about you. I'm not impressed with you. I will tell you what you need to hear, regardless of whether you want to hear it. Solomon brings his son on his staff. So what is his role going to be? He's going to be his advisor, his counselor. And he's going to bring a guy that says, listen, I need persister, black, white, you tell me how it is. And I don't want you to worry about hurting my feelings. You communicate it. So you look at the guys that he's bringing on, you're like, okay, I like it. All right? The king's friend, as he is described. Solomon in verse 7 has 12 deputies over Israel. Why 12 deputies? What would they do? 12 tribes. So what do you think their job is? You're Judah, okay? You're Zebulun, you're Dan. You oversee those sites. You are the governor. You report to me about what's going on. I can't be in 12 places, okay? Y'all do that. Is that good leadership? Absolutely. When the two harlots come and they need a decision made, now they're all not going to come to me. They can come to you. You can bring the harder stuff up to me, just like Moses did. Okay, so you see him. God didn't tell him to do this. He's realizing, I need to learn how to administrate a kingdom. I've got 3, 4, 5 million people to deal with. So let's do this rightly. Okay, verse 20, Judah and Israel were numerous as the sand that is on the seashore. They were eating and drinking and rejoicing. Solomon ruled over the kingdoms from the river of the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. Verse 24, he had peace on all sides. Verse 25, Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine and fig tree. What does that sound like to you? Peace. Prosperity. How is Solomon doing as a ruler? They love him. Man, we've got money in the bank. We're happy. We're at peace. You are executing justice in our land. Solomon, you're nailing it, right? At 20, he's doing a great job, okay? Now, 26, just a side note. Jane, read that.
Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses.
How many stalls for horses? Mine says 40,000. Either way, I have some friends that play polo. They buy horses. They've got 3 or 4 to ride in a day, okay? Horses aren't cheap. he's got 4,000 or 40,000. Either way, that's a lot, right? Would you say, i.e. Deuteronomy 17, that would be excessive use of horses? Yes. Okay, so he's got more than a few. We already see that he's beginning to acquire more than one wife, and there's other marriage alliances that we haven't read about that are coming. So he's got a lot of that. We're also going to find out that he's filthy loaded. Yeah.
What would be the purpose of having like 40,000? Is that a military thing?
Why not? I mean, if you got a black Lamborghini, you need a white one. Because what if you don't want to drive the white one? And you need the red one that day. I mean, duh, right? Why? Because you can. That's why. Because you can. It's ridiculous, but that was the one upmanship in that world, so everyone would know you're the guy. Okay, you displayed your riches.
How much land does Solomon have at this point?
Same as David. So he's pushed the Philistines out. They're at peace with them. Down all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba, right? That little two-fingered peninsula at the very, very bottom of the desert. He's pushed it a little bit further up north. He doesn't have troops up there per se, but he has allegiances, and he's making taxes on like Lebanon and up north and up there. So he's actually expanded a little bit further than David. Okay, so he has all the land that that David had had, and he's still continuing to rule over that. Okay, so quite a bit. All right. Yeah. God doesn't tell them the why. He doesn't say, he just says, don't do these things in Deuteronomy 17. He doesn't say, because this is what's going to happen. That this is what's going to happen, we're about to read about. But he knows, man, nobody can bear the weight of a ton of women, a ton of money, a ton of fame, a ton of horses. All those things equal this, and you're going to cave. So, and that's what happens, okay? So, yeah. Okay, now, he can hold it for a while, or he can fake like he can for a while, okay? God gave Solomon, verse 29, wisdom, great discernment, breadth of mind, like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east. I mean, these are the people that are famous, right? You go up the hill and ask the monks. I mean, you talk about the kings of the east. These were the people that were known for their wisdom. He's wiser than all of them, all men, okay? So he is, again, his fame is rising, okay? 34, men came from all places to hear Solomon's wisdom, for all the kings of the earth had heard of his wisdom. So when people show up just to listen to you speak, you're like, dude, that's impressive. So let me watch what happens when Solomon has two harlots in front of him and he's trying to figure out who's the lying mother and who's the real one. And they watch him do stuff like that and they go, I never would have thought of that. That was brilliant. Gosh, this guy's wise, right? He's discerning in real life situations, so it's amazing, okay? Now, chapter 5, we're going to build the temple, okay? Solomon has had the plans given to him by David. He drew up the papers. They've been approved by the city of Clovis. We're all good to build this thing. And they're now going to build the temple, okay? He taps his boy, Hiram, king of Tyre, up north on the shoulder and says, listen, you've got cedar trees. I live in a land of rocks. We're going to need that, but I need a bunch of supplies. Hiram, king of Tyre, was a guy that was friendly with David. He's going to be friendly with Solomon. He says, man, anything you need, you let me know. And he says, I need a group of trees. And Hiram says, done. And Solomon says, how much? And he says, they're yours. Okay. Solomon's going to pay him back in spades, but he gives him these things. Now, just to see the numbers and the amount it took to build this, okay? Solomon, in verse 13, levied forced labor from all of Israel. He numbered the forced laborers, numbering 30,000 men. Solomon, in verse 15, had 70,000 transporters, 80,000 hewers of stone in the mountains. He's got 80,000 stonemasons that are making rocks out of granite, or in their case, out of limestone and basalt rock to bring into the land. So 80,000 people that are just there. Your only job is to make rock. 70,000 people move wood. You're like, holy cow. Okay, 30,000 people. You're the labor. You're the on-site guys that are doing the work. Okay, so he's got a grip of people. All right. And Solomon basically in verse 5, by the way, 5:5, he says, I intend to build a house for the Lord. You can see that the Davidic covenant, Solomon sees him as a part of that. I'm going to build a house that my dad said he was going to build. He sees all this happening, okay? Now, by the way, this takes, according to chapter 9, verse 10, 20 years to build. I mean, we build a house in Fresno quickly in 3 to 4 months, okay? Long, six. Man, if it's custom, like high-end custom, maybe 2 years, right? If you're building a Fat Daddy in Carmel, right, and everything's done by hand, maybe a couple years, okay? 20 years it takes to build this monstrosity, okay? So 6 and 7, this is all about all the stuff that's in there. You guys can go through it. It is just, you talk about to the nines, this place was to the nines. It had anything and everything you can imagine, and then some, okay? In chapter 8, they finish this thing, and they're going to dedicate it, okay? And it's pretty cool. They have a ginormous party and celebrate the fact that God had done this thing. 8:1, they take the Ark of the Covenant from the city of David, which is in Zion. They bring it into their house. Verse 4, they brought up the Ark of the Covenant and the Tent of Meeting. Okay, I assume that's the tabernacle, which were in the tent. These were in Jerusalem, and now they're going to bring them into the house. Okay. Verse 5, they sacrificed so many sheep and oxen, they could not be counted or numbered. That's a lot, right? Thousands, I would assume. When you are offering, you're saying, this is God's house. We're going to offer it to you. Verse 11, the priests come in. It says, the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud and the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. They build this thing. God shows up and inhabits the temple. So sin or not sin for them to build it, God says, I'll honor that. I appreciate your hearts, and I will live there because that's in the center of the midst of my people.
Why might it be sin? What do you mean?
What's the difference between the tabernacle and the temple? Tabernacle can move.
Because it's always with them, the temple is stationary.
Okay, yep. In the book of Exodus, whose idea was it to build the tabernacle? God's. How much of the book of Exodus is dedicated to the details of the building of the tabernacle? Like half, right? And God says, build it exactly like this. The blueprints are from God. The instructions from God. The command to build it's from God. Where'd the temple come from? David's sitting at home one day in his lazy boy, and he's like, man, my house is fat. And there's God's house out there. He's in a shabby tent with a box underneath it. Something seems wrong. I should build God a house. There's nothing wrong with that. But God doesn't say, hey, David, tired of living in the tabernacle. I want you to build me a fat house. God says, I didn't want a fat house. Is it for you to build me a house? Or should I, God, build you a house? So it's not sin, but God never said build it. So if you look at that and go, man, that is interesting. God told Solomon or Moses, build a tabernacle. Never in Scripture do we see him say, build me a temple. I want to be like every other god of the nation who has a permanent house. God says, no, I want to be different. And I don't need some monstrosity. You want to put me in a monstrosity to say that your God is bigger. God doesn't need that. The people needed that. So God honors it. He dwells there. It's great. They pray in chapter 8 this amazing prayer about God be here, forgive our sins when we confess, when we do stupid, walk with us, right? Deal with our iniquities. God says, great, we'll still do all that. No problem. Okay, but that's the tension in it. So, and again, I haven't heard a whole lot of people that espouse that theology, but there was a guy that came with us to Israel a couple years ago that was like a half step under Solomon in terms of brilliance. And I went, wow, like, this is what he does. He teaches Old Testament at Ohio State. He's brilliant. Loves God. And he said, man, I don't think God wanted that to be built. And it just, I've never looked at it from that perspective and went, okay, I see your point. I don't like it. At first, I was like, you're dumb. I think it's not even that. I think the king was like, God really doesn't want that. I think this is a step below that. And like, it's not. Them wanting a king was basically saying to God. Right. Them wanting a house for God was saying, no. We want you here. We want to worship you, but we want you to have something awesome. And God's like, okay. Yeah, I think their heart was right. Their heart was wrong in wanting a king. So I don't even look at it as that extreme. So to say it's sin, I go, no, but that's not what God wanted. Yeah, Pete.
Was it built as the center of the city?
Yep.
So just like having
Yeah, so you got Jerusalem in the center of it on Mount Moriah, the highest place in the city. There's the temple. So it still, it represented all that was right. So there's a lot about you, yeah. And again, you look at chapter 8, Solomon prays in verse 22 before the altar, and he brings this prayer that's insane. And he just says, God, basically, honor us. When we screw up, forgive us. When we worship you, be honored in that. I mean, he just prays that God would be inhabited in this place, that they would walk with God, that he would be forgiving and gracious to them. It's amazing. So chapter 8 is a great picture of God honoring that. And he even prays for the captivity to come. Like, hey, when we get kicked out of the land, bring us back. We'll repent. We're going to confess our sins. I mean, chapter 8 is amazing. Okay, so it's just all of, basically, you guys can look through it. It's Solomon's prayer to God saying, please use this place because it's for you. Okay, verse 63, we get some numbers here. They offered sacrifice and peace offerings, which they offered to the Lord, 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. This is in addition to the stuff that they couldn't count before. Okay, then the king and all the sons of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord, 120,000 sheep. How long did that take? I mean, holy cow, that's a lot of sheep, right? Anyway, okay, so they celebrate for 7 days. On the last day, verse 66, he sent the people home, he blessed them, and said, man, y'all go enjoy life, okay? So it's pretty neat, all right? Now, chapter 9 and following, we're going to see Solomon's fame begin to spread, okay? God appears to Solomon, verse 2, chapter 9, a second time. He said, I've heard your prayer and supplication. Basically, I've heard chapter 8. I like your heart. Thanks. So, and he tells them in verse 4, if you will walk with me as your father David did, we're going to be all good. Keep my commandments. Verse 5, I will establish the throne of Israel over you forever. Okay, but if your sons turn away, Solomon, if you do stupid and the people of do after you, they do stupid. Verse 7, I will cut off Israel from the land given to them. I will boot them. Verse 8, this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss. Meaning, this house means nothing to me. I don't need it. I will destroy it that fast if you guys disobey me. I don't need this for me. I will honor it so long as you walk with me. But if you fail to do that, it's gone. And that's what happens. 586 BC, the Babylonians come in, and it says there was not a stone left unturned in Jerusalem. They demolish Solomon's temple, okay? So this thing stands for 400 plus years until 586, and then it's gone.
So if God didn't really necessarily want the temple, why is it such a big deal for, when it's rebuilt,
it's the physical symbol of God. So God still wanted a place of worship. So that was their cry to get back into the land. When they were booted from the land, there was no worship going on. There was no place to offer sacrifices. So they needed to reestablish something. And for them, that something was the temple. So that was important. So they still needed the altar. They needed the ark. They needed the place to atone for their sins. And they didn't have that. So that's the bigger picture. For the Babylonians?
Well, for anyone that would destroy the temple, like completely destroy it.
My God's bigger than your God. That's generally what these battles come down to. So the God of the Babylonians is bigger than your God, so we're going to destroy it. Now, we're also going to take all the gold with us, thank you very much, and all the things that you've done. We're going to take everything. So we're going to benefit from it, but we're not going to allow your house of worship to stand because that would say that your God is better than our God, and that's not true. So, yeah, okay. Now, chapter 10, there's some fascinating things about Solomon, by the way. We'll see in chapter 10. This is ridiculous how much money he has. Chapter 10, the Queen of Sheba comes. So current-day Saudi Arabia, if you take the finger of the Gulf of Aqaba and you follow it all the way south, Mecca's down that way. She comes on this long journey because she hears, dude, this guy is brilliant. So this queen comes and visits Solomon. She listens to Solomon. Verse 3, it says, Solomon answered all of her questions, and she's astonished. So Solomon isn't some politician that's evading questions. She asks, what about this? How do you administer that? Tell me about how you do this. And she's amazed by his wisdom and how he administrates his kingdom. And she says in verse 6, man, I heard one report. I heard you were Paul Bunyan and the ox. You're even more than that. Like, I had an overinflated view of you when I came in, and that wasn't even enough. So he's amazing in terms of his wisdom, okay? She pays him money based on how smart he is, okay? Verse 14, read that. Chapter 10, verse 14.
The weight of the gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold.
Okay, that, by the way, is 25 tons in a year. 25 tons of gold. Okay, that's an elephant is a ton. 25 tons, okay? Now, you saw a number in there. Did that make you go, why not 665? Why not 667? Okay? To a Jew, they would have done the same thing that you and I just did because we're learning to be Jewish. And you went, huh, does that say something? Yeah. In a Jewish culture, that would have spoken volumes. What is it saying? The amount of money that he has is evil. It's not good. Okay? So they wouldn't have been concerned about 25 tons. And like I just told you, they don't care about, they would have said, huh, it's getting to a place where it's too much. It's corrupting Solomon. That's evil, okay? So there are signs in a text like that. They would have not asked academic questions about it. They would have asked, there's that's a word picture, okay? That picture is, that's too much. I don't know if 665 was too much, but 666 is excessive, and it's turning Solomon's heart to evil, okay? Verse 18, he makes a throne of ivory, Solomon does, that would have been used in the temple. Verse 21, everything that he made was of gold, everything. Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. All the vessels in the house of the forest of Lebanon were gold. Nothing was of silver. It was considered of zero value in Solomon's day. Silver was useless. It was like $1 bills. You just blew your nose in them. You know, I got hundreds. I don't need 20s, okay? They were useless. Verse 27, the king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. Now, that's like saying the king made Fresno hard pan. Like that's like we have it in spades here. You want hard pan? We got it everywhere, right? We got silver everywhere. I can take a bath in it, right? I've got as much silver as I want. It's of no value. Okay, that's how rich they were. Okay, so next week, chapter 11, 2 weeks from now, chapter 11, we will watch the downfall of Solomon. Okay, so this is where it all goes south. So no residency next week. You guys enjoy your spring break. We'll be back. We got 2 weeks after we get back, okay, to do some serious work in the text. Okay, so I think I'm confident we're going to get somewhere. Yeah, I'm confident I'll be here. Okay. It wouldn't be a bad idea just for you guys to start doing some review and prep together for the final. It would...